is there any place you can look? Is any time of the day you can turn on the television or the radio for that matter? Do you remember when you used to get in your car and drive to work and the morning show was that you listened to was, you know, lively and funny? It wasn't crude. It wasn't laced with sexual innuendo. Do you remember when you could actually turn on the television and watch a sitcom that wasn't laced with double entendre and sexual innuendo and explicit sexual references? It seems like so long ago. And then, and don't get me started, then there's advertising. It seems as though the exploitation of sex is everywhere, and there's a simple reason for that. Sex sells. We're going to talk about that during the first half hour of Issues, Etc. Pastor Eric Andre is our guest. He'll join us here in just a moment. We've got a very full day today, culminating with a very interesting open lines here on Issues, Etc. During the second half hour of the program, Terry Mattingly joins us. He's from Scripps Howard News Service. He has a syndicated column there, a nationally syndicated column called On Religion. We have several things to talk with him about. One you may have heard in the promo, while they were consecrating the first openly gay bishop here in the United States in the former Soviet Union, a church was bulldozed because its pastor performed a gay wedding. He'll tell us that story when he joins us in the second half hour of Issues, Etc. In the second hour of the program, a full hour with Pastor Richard Stuckwish. No, I'm sorry, a half hour, I mean. We're going to be talking about this coming Sunday, the last Sunday of the church year, the Sunday of the Fulfillment. Pastor Richard Stuckwish will be our guest. Amy White joins us after that. From about 4:30 till, maybe quarter till the hour, we'll find out what she has to say. She's written a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch called The New Pilgrim's Progress, drawing some connections between the war on terrorism and the exploits and trials and hardships of the founders of this nation. Kind of apropos for this time of the year as we approach Thanksgiving. And then, in the last hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. When Rush Limbaugh lost his hearing, do you remember when that happened? He went deaf. People speculated, well, you know, he's going to get some serious treatment here, and this has given him a real hardship and a handicap that he's going to have to live with the rest of his life. People speculated in the press. I read several articles at the time that we'd get a kinder and gentler Rush Limbaugh from that experience. Well, the speculation started up again when it was discovered and revealed that he had a serious prescription drug addiction. He went away for 5 weeks, came back this week. So he's back on the air. Was it this week or last week, Gary, that he came back? I can't remember. It was this week that he came back. Came back on the air. People were wondering, a kinder and gentler Rush? I'll be honest with you, that's what I thought, especially after I heard that first day when he came back. Not only kinder and gentler, but touchier and feelier. Maybe even a little more new age. I'd like your reaction to the return of Rush Limbaugh in the last hour of Issues, Etc., and whether or not you detect something different in his tone and in his rhetoric. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Eric Andre is campus pastor at First Trinity Lutheran Church in Pittsburgh. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled The World of Sexploitation. Pastor Andre, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be with you again, Todd. Thank you.
Is there any place we can look where sex is not used as a tool for selling us something?
I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any place. I was just thinking as you were speaking here, introducing the topic, that just the other night I was at a Penguins ice hockey game. And for the first time, I noticed that we're actually cheerleaders at the hockey game and very scantily clad. Not that it's wrong to be a cheerleader necessarily, but obviously using sex as a tool to sell the game. And I had never heard of or seen cheerleaders before at a hockey game. So I think basically every area, every product that is attempted to be thrust upon us and sold to us uses sexuality or a perversion thereof in order to get us to buy into it.
At a hockey game, I have a hard enough time just trying to figure out where the puck is without being distracted by scantily clad cheerleaders.
Yeah.
Well, all right. It's been common practice in our culture, especially the pop culture, for sex to be used to sell clothes, cars, perfume. But nowadays, it seems as though everything is sold through this method. Where is it encroaching most lately, according to your observations?
Well, I think it's not so much where it's encroaching, but maybe the target audience has expanded. And that was kind of the point of what I was saying in my article on Higher Things and some of the things that I've seen that I didn't even get to in my article. But, for example, Abercrombie & Fitch, a retail clothing store which really targets teenagers, certainly young adults, their catalog, which supposedly is not supposed to be sold to anyone under 18, includes nudity, it includes references to group sex, all kinds of things. It's basically a pornographic magazine used to sell clothing to youth. So it's not, I think, so much that it's been anything new in the last, 10 years or so. I think with the sexual revolution in the 60s, we've seen sexuality in just about every realm, but it's, I think that the target audience has expanded. You see it in popular music with such stars as Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, who over the past couple years have really turned up the heat, so to speak. And these are stars that normally their product has been targeted towards young girls. I mean, who over age 25 is going to buy a Britney Spears or Christina Aguilera CD? Not very many people. And yet they have, lesbian kissing on the MTV Music Awards with Madonna. More and more scant outfits, and so again, it's not the realm, but it's the target audience has expanded or simply gone lower, I think.
My wife and I were having that very conversation earlier this week when I think in advertisement for an upcoming CD that she's trying to sell, Britney Spears was all over television. You couldn't get away from her.
Yes.
And my wife was asking out loud, for years she's made a very lucrative living selling to the teeny bopper.
Yes.
To the young girl. And now, all of a sudden, she seems to be aiming at an entirely different audience, perhaps the young boy, one might wonder. But she asked, why? Why this transformation? The only answer I could come up with is she's trying to keep up with everybody else.
She's trying to keep up, and it looks like she's surpassing. I mean, her role model right now is Madonna, and we know that Madonna has been at the forefront for, goodness, it must be, 15, 20 years, it seems like, at the forefront, not only of successful in terms of record sales, pop music, but also pushing the envelope in terms of sexuality and many other ways as well. And that's really her role model. They're making videos together. As I alluded to, they performed at the MTV Music Awards together. And that's really her role model. And I think that's a shame, because when Britney Spears first started out, of course, from the Mickey Mouse Club and in Disney, and even early on, she made a very strong point that she wanted to be a role model for younger women. She spoke of her chastity, for example, very openly. All that has changed. That has changed with her persona, her clothing, even the lyrics on her new album. There's some very, not so implicit lyrics dealing with sexuality in a way that's certainly not God pleasing.
You mentioned Abercrombie and Finch, and we actually did a show once, and I can't remember what it was called. It had something to do with thongs. I know that, where we were talking about the sexualization of teenage girls,
mm-hmm.
and of prepubescent girls as well, children,
sure.
I guess you could say, in the kind of clothes that they're being sold. You sit around with an average group of women who have to buy clothes for their daughters, and they'll tell you they can hardly find anything that they consider appropriate to their age.
Sure.
It's getting scantier earlier and earlier.
Yeah, I mean, the way that some of the girls that are 12, 13, the way that they dress today is, I'm not that old. I'm only 32, but I don't recall that so much from my fifth and sixth grade years. I just don't. But, on the other hand, I think we don't want to be prudes either, but there comes a point where for the girl's own self-image, for her image that she's putting out, giving forth to other young boys, there comes a line where she's hurting herself, and she's causing, to put it in the least way, she's causing distraction for others and creating a stumbling block, if you will, and it's neither healthy for the girl, as she's, as her body is still developing, as she's still learning about herself, about her sexuality, about her femininity, and she should be learning this from role models such as hopefully her mother, her Christian mother, her other respected authority figures in her life, her pastor, her Sunday school teacher. But instead, she's learning it from images promoted by the media, and the media doesn't care at all about her. They simply care about selling their product, be it clothes, be it pop music, be it magazines, be it what have you. And I think, you know, it's really a shame. And the one that it's the shame the most for is the one that's being exploited, be it the young girl or the young boy, teenagers of either sex.
You have summarized this, I think, very succinctly by saying what we're watching here, what we're being lured toward, is style over substance.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the image always sells more and sticks more in our mind, is more memorable than the words that come with it. So the thing that led me to write this article for Higher Things, and as I've been mulling it over my mind as a topic in general lately, was one night when I was in at Barnes & Noble, and I was looking at the magazine section, I was looking at the lifestyle and entertainment sections and sports sections, just kind of browsing, and I noticed that an unbelievably high percentage of the magazines had simply the word sex or a form thereof on the front cover, let alone, of course, the typical pictures of, you know, half-naked or three-quarter-naked women on the cover, pitching everything from bikinis to, you know, home care products. But an unbelievable amount, I would say three-quarters, 75% of the magazine covers had the word sex or form thereof. Now, of course, the word sex is not a bad word. It's a good word, and it describes something that's been given to us by God, but it's the perversion of it. And, you know, the covers were, you know, the 100 sexiest women, the 32 unbelievable sexy pages, 769% more sex, and so on and so forth, 22 sex bomb bathing suits. And it was this marketing of sexuality as a product, as a means to an end, the end being really the manipulation of not just youth but adults as well in order to sell a product, rather than being held forth as something precious that should be valued, that should be put forth in, you know, in a wholesome, God-pleasing way.
We're talking with Pastor Eric Andre. He's campus pastor at First Trinity Lutheran Church in Pittsburgh. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled The World of Sexploitation. We're talking about the exploitation of sex. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, we have about 10 more minutes left with Pastor Andre. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Someone's going to say, Pastor, look, there's sex in the Bible. I've read it. It's in there. What is the proper biblical perspective that Christians are to take on the human body, on human sexuality?
Well, I think that the Christian biblical perspective on the human body and sexuality has, in a sense, two equal starting points. One is God is our creator. He has given us our bodies. He has created us male and female in his image. The other is that God is also our redeemer in Christ, and that Christ was incarnated, that he became a body. He became a man. He became flesh, and therefore has sanctified the physical. There's nothing wrong with the physical in and of itself. Indeed, it's a great good. God has given us this body. God became one of us in the body of Jesus Christ. He redeems this body. He pours water on this body and marks us with a cross on this body in baptism. So we know that it is good. God saw all that he had made, and indeed the height of his creation, creating man, male and female, and said that it was good. That's the overall general perspective. Of course, the fullest expression then of our God-given sexuality, the mutual interdependence and literal fitting, if you will, of male and female, the fullest expression of that is in the emotional and physical love of God-pleasing marriage, one man, one woman, and a lifelong commitment to one another. That, of course, maybe is not much comfort to the 13-year-old or 14-year-old boy whose hormones are exploding and hasn't had the first thought about getting married. I think we have a challenge in the church, as pastors, as parents, as lay leaders, to present sexuality to our children, to the youth, in a way in which they can also participate in that gift of God without perverting it. In other words, without extramarital or premarital sexual relations, but provide opportunities for members of the opposite sex, whether it be in youth group, of course, in church, and so on, and teach them how to treat each other with respect and to listen to each other, to learn about one's body by asking trusted people, especially parents, of course, questions. And being honest with each other, not only with the opposite sex, but with parents as things go along. And having wholesome, you know, dating opportunities when the age is right, when parents decide that that age is right. But we have to, I think that's a great challenge. It's something I'm still thinking through. How can we, as the church, say to youth in some way that sexuality is good and it is, there is a place for you within that realm, even before marriage, or do we just say to them, well, you know, marriage is 10 years off for you, and until then, sexuality is bad? No, but the sexuality is part of who we are as physical beings and how we relate to members of the opposite sex. And I think, you know, for example, just physical health is part of that. Physical activity, sports, keeping our bodies healthy. And, of course, prayer, receiving the Lord's body and blood into our bodies, confessing our sins when we fall short, and hearing into our ears, into our bodies, the forgiveness of the Lord when we sin. I think we have to explore more of these ways in which we can, in a God-pleasing, biblical way, present and honestly and openly talk about sexuality with the youth of the church.
An observation, certainly not original or unique to me, that a compromised church, especially as we've seen it kind of playing itself out this last year with the Episcopal Church USA,
yes,
and other liberal church bodies, a compromised church seems to inevitably become obsessed with deviant sexual behavior. Why is this?
It's interesting because I think one aspect of it, there's many aspects, but one is that those who tend to side with what happened in the consecration or desecration, if you will, of the openly homosexual bishop, Vicki Jean Robinson, in the Episcopal Church, is that, and as Scripture tells us, of course, darkness cannot stand the truth. Falsehood cannot stand the light. And so I found it very telling that at the consecration of this bishop, there was an Episcopal pastor here in the Pittsburgh diocese, actually, who spoke. There was a time where those who were opposed were welcome to speak, and there was to be no interruption, no applause, no booing either, just simply a respectful silence. And this priest spoke, and he mentioned some of the abominable acts which a majority, a vast majority, well over 90% in some cases, of homosexuals engage. Some of the abominable activity, which I won't even mention because it's a family show, but I thought it was right of him to do that in that setting. Well, he was quickly silenced by Bishop Griswold, the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, and then roundly criticized in papers across the country and here in Pittsburgh for bringing this up. He said they said he should be ashamed of himself for saying these things and he should be defrocked. Meanwhile, no shame, supposedly, for the bishop, Robinson, who engages in these activities. So I think it's a matter of simply, we must speak the truth. We must speak it in love, of course, but we must speak the truth because ultimately truth will prevail. Truth will conquer because Christ is the way, the truth, and life, and he is victorious for us.
I don't know if you saw this, but I know you keep your ear very close to the pop culture, being pop culture editor for Higher Things. But there was very recently in my estimation, an ill-fated but well-intentioned effort at being clever, the production of what was called a Bible zine called Revolve that was modeled after a girl's kind of teen magazine replete with pictures of cute boys saying that they like their girls to dress modestly and spiritual makeover tips and things like that. What do you make of this, Pastor Andre?
That's very interesting. I have to admit that though I am, as you put it, a pop culture editor, I guess I'm not in tune with all of these things. I have not heard of that. I think the effort certainly sounds well-intentioned. We have to be careful, on the other hand, to understand sanctification and holiness as simply taking things of the world or worldly things and kind of baptizing them in the name of Jesus and then saying all things are okay as long as we mouth the right things. There are things of this world, ways of dressing, ways of speaking, ways of acting, ways of moving, that no matter how much we try to sanctify them, they cannot be. Sometimes sanctification simply means what it actually means at its root, which is to be set apart, to be different from. You know, I think of Romans 12, be not conformed to the ways of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, and I would, you know, say by the renewing, and that includes the renewing of your mind, body, spirit, all things, by the Holy Spirit. I as I said, I can't really speak to the issue directly because I haven't seen it, but I think we have to tread carefully there, all of us.
I wonder, you mentioned before the sexual revolution as part of the genesis of sexploitation as we see it in the media and the culture. But I wonder whether or not there are even more terrible outcomes of the sexual revolution besides the sexualization of almost everything we see, touch, taste, and smell.
Oh, sure. Well, and I think, I mean, that's, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Todd, because ultimately this sexploitation of the media to sell its product ends up not only selling the product, of course, but ends up in those who are exploited selling their souls. I mean, there's no doubt that the images work on our minds and can often lead to sexual sin. That's the whole point. It's not just that we buy a product that we don't want or support a message, an image that we don't want to support. That's bad enough in and of itself. But it's that these things lead to promiscuity. We have a sinfulness inside of us that can be worked up by these things. As Luther said, you know, we cannot prevent the birds from circling our head, but we don't have to build a nest for them. And if we continually expose ourselves and support these type of things, we can and will fall into sexual sin. We are only strong as we are in the Lord and in His ways. We are not strong enough in and of ourselves. And so these things lead to sexual promiscuity. They lead to teenage unwed pregnancy. They lead to abortion. They lead to maybe homosexual exploration and all manner of ill that ultimately deadens the soul and can indeed shipwreck and kill our faith. They harm our relationship with our Savior. That's the ultimate point. And that's only one or two steps away when we're talking about this perverted image of sexuality that's constantly thrust upon us by the secularists.
While we want to be cautious of, as you just said, of allowing ourselves to be desensitized by this exploitation of our culture and everything we find around us, does it mean then that the Christian must remove himself or herself from any and all influences of the pop culture?
You know, I think it's an excellent question and one that I have been mulling over more and more lately. Christ prayed to the Father in his high priestly prayer that his disciples may be kept safe in the world, but not be taken out of the world. If we are taken out of the world and if we were to remove ourselves from any and all influences, as you said, of pop culture, we couldn't leave our home or apartment. We simply couldn't. Nor could we then evangelize and share the good news of Jesus Christ, nor could we then speak out against those things, which we must do as a church. That is one of the, we are to be heralds for the culture. That is one of the roles of the culture, of the church, rather, in this culture. I think, though, it's a very fine line. We must surround ourselves with faithful ministry of word and sacraments, faithful, devout, supportive Christian friends and family, and we must continually ourselves daily be in the word and in prayer. Those are the things with which we can arm ourselves in this battle against the forces of evil. Otherwise, we too can succumb. I think we have to be careful, and I think especially many of us listening to the show who are Lutherans, but all Christians, we have to be careful to say, well, it's by grace alone and through faith alone we are saved, so I'm free to indulge in all things. St. Paul says we are free, but not all things are beneficial. And I think we have to be careful neither to become legalistic, but nor to turn our liberty into license.
Pastor Eric Andre, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Todd, my pleasure. Thank you.
Pastor Eric Andre has authored an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled The World of Sexploitation. Go to the website for Higher Things by going first to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the links with regular guests, you'll find Todd Peppercorn and Higher Things magazine.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you know God's will for your daily life? Is God's will a mystery? Do we need to look for a sign from God to know what to do at any given moment? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article in the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal titled Locus and Focus, God's Will for Your Daily Life. The recent issue also contains a review of Armageddon, the latest in the Left Behind series, and Aaron Wolf details his spiritual journey to the Reformation from the legalism of evangelicalism. His article is titled A Beggar on the Wittenberg Trail. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive the next edition of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write Issues Etc. Journal, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear about an opportunity to pray for a new Christian radio station that serves needy peoples in the southern third of Sudan. Radio Peace broadcasts in local Arabic, Nuer, and Dinka languages several hours a day. This station, developed by the Ministry Global Endeavor, operates inside the East African country of Sudan. It's vulnerable to attack by the Islamic regime in power in Sudan. The plan is to distribute radio sets throughout southern Sudan so that tens of thousands more can listen to Radio Peace. Pray that this new station, which provides coverage across several hundred miles, will have a powerful impact for the gospel. Pray that both the persecuted and the persecutors will hear of God's truth and love. Learn more about praying for this project by visiting the website globalendeavor.org. That's globalendeavor.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. The other day I told you Diane was out of town, and I quickly turned the kitchen into a dump. On day two of batching it, I loaded all the dirty dishes into the dishwasher. Now, where's the soap? Ah, this looks good. Ultra Sunlight Concentrated Dishwashing Liquid. I poured that into the thingamajig on the inside of the door, closed the door, turned on the dishwasher, and walked away quite pleased with myself. 20 minutes later, the proud one returned to find the kitchen floor covered with soap suds. It took 6 towels to clean up that mess. I inherited my ineptitude. When my dad retired, he helped out around the house. Instead of moving dust around with a cloth, he vacuumed everything. That was okay, until he came to the shelf where my mom displayed her collection of ceramic thimbles. That big sucking noise the neighbor heard was the thimbles disappearing into the vacuum. We all know that the simplest household chores require some knowledge. Isn't it strange, then, that people imagine that any religious opinion is true and no religious opinion is wrong? Now that's a real mess that towels can't clean up.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like By the Way, our thought for the day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, it's The Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment, features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., a 2-hour discussion on the removal of Judge Roy Moore. Dr. David Adams joins us for that discussion. Very interesting indeed. He's from Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We'll be talking about Judge Roy Moore and his removal from the Supreme Court of Alabama tomorrow on Issues Etc. Did you hear about the church in the former Soviet Union that was bulldozed? This happened rather recently. I was curious as to why they would bulldoze a church. Go back, 20 years, 30 years, and you might have thought, well, the communists are bulldozing the church. That was not the reason. We're going to talk about that story, among others, in a religion roundup, a Christianity and culture roundup, with Terry Mattingly during the remainder of this first hour of Issues Etc. Terry Mattingly is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's associate professor of media and religion at Palm Beach Atlantic University, and author of a nationally syndicated column for Scripps Howard News Service called On Religion. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello there.
Tell us what happened in the former Soviet Union with this Orthodox church being bulldozed. And if you would, for the sake of our audience, juxtapose that with what was happening almost at precisely the same time here in the United States.
Well, simply stated, the press details on exactly what happened in Russia are a little bit vague. If you go to Google and do a search for information on this, you find out that some people thought it was a press ruse, that a man and a woman, the woman being a newspaper reporter at a Soviet newspaper, went to this priest and said, "We'd like to get married." Only the next day, or when they showed up for the actual ceremony, all of a sudden it was two guys, and the reporter was with them, but they, you know, or some people claim the priest was tricked into doing this same-sex rite. Others, simply including the newspaper reporter in question, said that they just simply bribed the priest, that he was paid, you know, a flat amount of money to do it. The reason I made a reference to it was simply to note that whatever the circumstances, the reaction of the hierarchy of the Russian Orthodox Church could hardly be faulted for clarity. They immediately defrocked the priest, which means, you know, removed him from the priesthood, and then literally bulldozed the church down and then burned the wreckage.
Because the priest had performed, for whatever reason, a gay wedding ceremony.
Right. In other words, they said this sanctuary has been defiled, and it has been defiled to such a degree, we're taking it down. Now, the press reports go on to say that it was a small chapel, and there was some talk that it might be replaced someday anyway. But needless to say, no one was exactly confused about the doctrinal stance being taken by the bishops, would you say?
I don't think so.
So the reason I used that as an opening was because a lot of people online were then confused when there were initial reports that an Orthodox, an Eastern Orthodox bishop, had taken part in the ritual to consecrate Bishop Gene Robinson as the first openly gay, non-celibate bishop in the U.S. Episcopal Church and in the entire global Anglican Communion. So a lot of people were stunned to hear this Orthodox, that there was an Orthodox bishop who was there observing the ceremony, not taking part in the ceremony, but even observing it. It turned out, after doing a little bit of work and hunting it down, but several of us discovered that this was a bishop of a tiny, tiny, tiny little splinter church that was not in communion with the rest of Eastern Orthodoxy. So, you know, there are hundreds of churches that claim some connection to Catholicism, you know, that are not recognized as Catholic by, you know, by the Vatican. Meanwhile, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of similar Orthodox churches in America, and there are something like, what did I say in the column, 16 or 18 Ukrainian churches alone.
16, you said, yes.
Yeah. So, so anyway, the point I was trying to make is we're, the whole world right now, the entire ecumenical world is up in arms and freaking out about this consecration of the gay bishop here in the United States. And so I used that incident in Russia as a kind of a door opener to a discussion of how the Orthodox hierarchy and the Roman Catholic hierarchy, the two largest churches in Christendom, how those churches have responded to this news story.
One of the things that saddened me as we were watching it very closely here on Issues, etc., the consecration of Gene Robinson as the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA, saddened me really to see who was there, who was participating. I was momentarily encouraged that the presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the largest Lutheran church body in the United States, wasn't, I don't know if he was in attendance, but he did not participate. But then I discovered upon reading your column that someone was there representing Lutherans and claimed to also be representing the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
Christopher Sindall was there, a very, very famous bishop from Europe. And at the ceremony, two people who participated in the ceremony both confirmed that it was announced that he was there representing the ELCA. And I confirmed that with the, and quoted, the Episcopal priest who served, was one of the planners of the ceremony, and the man who served as this Lutheran bishop's chaplain. A chaplain is someone who assists a bishop during the ritual, holds books for him, etc. And this, the chaplain to this European famous theologian, Stendhal, that chaplain said that there was no question that it was announced that he represented the ELCA and that there were other ELCA clergy present. Now, if you read the press releases from the ELCA, there's been no mention of that anywhere. But, of course, all of this is controversial because the ELCA has a concordat with the Episcopal Church here in America that they now represent and the validity of each other's ordinations and sacraments, which means Bishop Gene Robinson is literally now a bishop in the Evangelical Lutheran Church as well.
One more question on this subject. This has struck many people, that whenever the press refers to V. Gene Robinson as the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA, the term openly is rather glaring there. What is being said there, not only by the press, but by the Episcopal Church USA when they say, here's our first openly gay bishop?
Well, of course, they're saying that there are other gay bishops who are in the closet. So the significance of that statement is, this is a man who's making a theological case that a non-celibate gay male can serve, as opposed to someone who is gay and celibate or gay and in the closet.
Terry, do you care to speculate about what this is going to mean in the long run for the Episcopal Church USA and the Anglican Communion?
Well, I've written columns about this dating all the way back into the late 90s. You know, we've all known this was coming. This is not the first election in which Gene Robinson was a candidate. Some expected him to be elected in Newark, New Jersey, a couple of years ago. Everybody's known this was coming. The crucial thing is, I think the American press is framing this story, for the most part, with by the way, the strong exception of National Public Radio. And National Public Radio, I think, is probably doing the best job of covering this story of anyone in the American media. The American press has framed this story as the story of a small number of conservative Episcopalians trying to split the Episcopal Church over the ordination of this gay bishop. The actual framing device for this story should be global, because the Anglican Communion is one global church that claims Catholic rights and Catholic orders of priests and bishops.
77 million strong,
yeah.
By the way.
So the story here is how a small group of people in Europe, America, and to some degree New Zealand, a small group of Western Christians, are causing a crisis in the wider Anglican Communion, taking an action that clashes with the beliefs of the overwhelming majority of the world's Anglicans, especially those in third world countries in Asia and Africa. So the issue is not whether the conservatives are splitting the American church, but whether a small group of extremely well-funded Western progressives are splitting the global Anglican Communion. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense.
And see, this is a part of a larger story. The same tensions between a more conservative, vital, Orthodox with a small O church in the third world, the same story is dominating the Presbyterian Church, the United Methodist Church to some degree, and this is going to be the story of the next conclave to pick the next pope in the Vatican, which is John Paul II has done an amazing job of switching the dynamics of the College of Cardinals from being primarily a European Western institution into one that represents more of the attendance and worship life statistics of the wider Roman Catholic world, which means an increasing number of Black, Hispanic, Asian, etc. faces in the College of Cardinals. Same story, just a different expression of it.
You mentioned the Presbyterians, and you've written recently on what you consider to be an eminent divorce, perhaps, among the Presbyterians, in particular the largest Presbyterian church body in the U.S., the Presbyterian Church USA, about 2.5 million members there. What's going on?
Well, just some candid discussion of what everybody's been talking about behind the scenes. You dealt there with an active layman and a lawyer from Kansas who has openly floated a divorce proposal, in effect. And the reason I wrote about that at the time was he was openly discussing what Anglicans, Methodists, Presbyterians, Lutherans, and everybody else are discussing behind the scenes, which is how do you divide up the family and the family property in a divorce?
So, actually, that sounds like encouraging news, that they're willing to be honest with one another about the real theological rifts that exist in that church body.
Well, at the moment, it's only one side. The other side is still really denying that this problem is this crucial, and they're basically standing in the wake of the L.A. riots saying, can't we all get along?
Okay, so which side is being honest and saying our differences are so great that we might consider not being in fellowship with one another anymore in the way that we were, and which side is saying, with their hands firmly planted over their ears, you know, this will go away if we just ignore it long enough?
Right now, the conservatives are being more theologically candid than the left. But see, the left believes, as a principle of its theological approach, that yin and yang can coexist. That's a part of being a pluralist. So the conservatives are the ones who are offended by the pluralism that the dominant hierarchies and establishment of these churches welcome, or say they welcome.
What are the issues that the Presbyterian Church USA, and as you've mentioned, so many other mainline church bodies, what are the issues? We mentioned the homosexual issue of ordination, and gay marriage would be one. What other ones are there?
Well, you know, that's a good point. Everybody is focusing on the sexuality issue. I've argued for a long time that the dominant issue behind the scenes is actually universalism, the belief that people are saved by faith and the grace of Jesus Christ alone versus that all people are saved through whatever beliefs they happen to have. It doesn't really matter what you believe as long as you're sincere. I've argued that universalism is actually the issue that is behind the scene that is the best bellwether issue. I angered a couple of Anglicans online, some Anglican conservatives, by asking the following question, and you know, this might be something for your listeners to think about as a framing device. Why is it worse to have an out-of-the-closet, non-celibate, gay bishop than to have bishops who do not believe in the resurrection, do not believe that salvation is through Christ alone, and in several cases are no longer even theists?
So it sounds as though we're not talking about someone to say, well, we're just kind of quibbling over details here. The main point is getting lost in the shuffle. We're talking about two entirely different pictures, in some cases, of Christianity itself.
Yeah, a decade ago, I wrote an article, which is in the freelance section of my website, called Liturgical Dances with Wolves. And we recently hit the 10-year anniversary of an event in there, the Feast of St. Francis of Assisi in 1993 at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. And at that event, which was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, the man who was at that time Bishop of New York took part in a ritual that literally, at a key moment in the service, as bread and wine were being brought in, the choir and the musicians were singing praises to Ra and Ashrah, the gods of Egypt, as bread and wine were being brought in.
So some
of the third world bishops are beginning to realize that the theological experimentation in the West has gotten to the point where it's actually begun to approach a true syncretism of competing world religions into one yin-yang whole.
You mentioned that, and I was put in mind immediately of this summer when the United Church of Christ joined together for their General Assembly, and they had two very interesting things occur there. One was the logo for the assembly, which was a depiction of the earth and kind of a goddess growing out of the earth, and in a bowl she's carrying in her hand, she shelters the whole human race there. This was to depict, according to the description of the logo, the divine feminine. That was the logo for the United Churches of Christ.
And the service that I was at in 1993 was a Gaia Mass.
Really?
That was the name of it, the Earth Mass.
Well, the other event that took place this summer at the UCC General Assembly was a liturgical dance in which the choir, singing traditional Christian hymns, slowly through dance movements, disrobed, revealing that they were the opposite genders that they presented themselves to be initially. A little
right.
gender switching going on there. What is happening, Terry?
Just a continuation of the basic trends that we've seen in American religion for several decades.
You know, you would expect this from New Agers? You would expect this from...
No. There's an interesting United Methodist theologian named Tom Oden. And Tom Oden is someone who used to be a theological liberal and already had tenure teaching in a United Methodist seminary when a strange thing happened. And as he just simply says, he got saved. And it's an embarrassing thing when someone gets saved after they already have tenure. Because you can't fire him. So Tom Oden is still there. And he's in the midst of a massive scholastic project on the writings of the ancient church fathers.
Yeah, the ancient church father commentary. Yeah.
Exactly. And Oden, you might remember that quite a few years ago there was a burst of news coverage involving the issue of Sophia, you know, and the goddess, and the wisdom goddess. And I called Tom Oden up for his reaction to this because he had written a very provocative article about it. And I was talking about this as if this was something new. And Tom Oden laughed finally and said, you know, he said, Terry, Sophia isn't news. She has tenure. That, you know, that we're looking at something that has been commonplace in theological education now for at least two generations.
Does the average layperson in the United Church of Christ or the Presbyterian Church USA or the Episcopal Church USA or any of the other mainline denominations that are flirting with this stuff or just simply have adopted it, do they buy this?
Well, I don't know if they buy it. I don't know if they know about it. The issue in many cases is what zip code they live in. And most of these theological debates end up producing a kind of a conflict map that resembles the famous USA Today red-blue map in the wake of the 2000 election. How you believe on a lot of these issues, to some degree, does seem to be reflected in your zip codes, which is why so many of the Episcopal dioceses here in America that are fighting the church hierarchy on the gay ordination issue can be found in the Bible Belt and in the Sun Belt. Although the notable exception to that, although Western Pennsylvania is actually pretty conservative, if you know anything at all about that region. The Bishop of Pittsburgh, Robert Duncan, has emerged as probably the most articulate spokesman for the conservative Episcopalians, along with the Bishop of Dallas, James Stanton.
So back to the issue of the Presbyterian Church USA, just to tie up the loose string there, how likely do you believe this so-called gracious separation is to occur?
I think that there is a much better chance of a blizzard here in Palm Beach, Florida on Christmas Day than that happening.
So what,
because the financial stakes are too high, involving millions, millions and millions of dollars of pension funds and property. I would be stunned if anybody successfully negotiates a parting of the ways. Let me let you know how high the stakes are. The Episcopal Church in its charter, it's my understanding, is defined as the church that is in communion with Canterbury. If the Third World Anglicans command the Archbishop of Canterbury to break communion with the current hierarchy of the Episcopal Church, or let's even say the Queen of England orders him to, and he were to do so, does that mean that the conservatives here in America get all of the pension funds, all of the massive endowments of wealth that belong to churches such as Trinity Wall Street? Does that mean they get the keys to the National Cathedral on the bluff overlooking Washington, D.C.?
So what happens to the average Episcopalian or Presbyterian sitting in the pew who does not know that this is the prevailing direction of their church? who, if they did know, would be shocked, and who simply holds to the scriptures and to the Savior revealed therein? What becomes that person with churches that are held together only by pension plans and retirement funds?
Well, you just described several different groups of people. Most of the people who have fairly traditional beliefs are, for the most part, pretty highly involved, literate, and are up on this. The person who just sits in the pew oblivious and doesn't know what's going on is usually someone who doesn't have strong theological convictions, which would lead them to either A, fight, B, pack up, move out of their sanctuary and go start another church, or C, join an ancient church such as Rome or Eastern Orthodoxy. Although many, there are lots of people who are leaving the mainline Protestant churches now to go to Rome or into my own church, Eastern Orthodoxy.
Terry, finally, with only a minute, does this then explain why many of the mainline denominations in America, many of them largely liberal, have suffered about a 30% loss of their membership over the last 30 years?
That and birth rate. The more elite segments of our society also tend to have the smallest birth rate. But I hope to jump on this in a column in the next week or two. There's an amazing study out of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill on the beliefs of Episcopal young people, showing that young people raised in the Episcopal Church have theological beliefs that are to the left of the secular world.
We hope to hear from you on that and many other subjects. Terry, it's always very stimulating talking to you. Thank you for being our guest.
Thanks a bunch.
Terry Mattingly is Associate Professor of Media and Religion at Palm Beach Atlantic University and author of a nationally syndicated column for Scripps Howard News Service called On Religion. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Pastor Richard Stuckwish. This coming Sunday is the last Sunday of the church year, sometimes called the Sunday of Fulfillment, End Time. It has several names. Some churches celebrate, I think they call it Christ the King Sunday. We're going to talk about Sunday of the Fulfillment for about a half hour when we come back with Pastor Richard Stuckwish, pastor of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana. Now, you can read Terry Mattingly's weekly On Religion column, if you'd like to, on the web at tmatt.net. That's T-M-A-T-T.net. When we come back, Pastor Richard Stuckwish, then we'll be talking a little bit with Amy White, and after that, Open Lines opens for the last hour of the program. We'll be talking about the return of Rush Limbaugh to radio. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.